Okay. Hello, and welcome to the Jolly Heretic. I am most violently sorry for the delay. I was dressing up as Amelia, and it took longer than I thought it would. No, I didn't. I sent out the wrong link. I sent out the offline recording link rather than the live link, and so this has caused all kinds of delays. So I'm sorry about that, chaps. No, I feel, as Paul said, you're an idiot. So hello, everybody, and yeah, I'll take this off now. It's a bit annoying. But cheers, as Paul said, you're an idiot. So hello, everybody, and yeah, I'll take this off now.
What the hell's happening?
Get rid of your other browser.
Have I done? So hello, everybody, and yeah, I'll take this off now.
What the hell's happening?
Get rid of your other browser.
What have I done?
You've got it open twice.
I haven't. Somebody else has. Okay, it seems to be closed now. Okay, so
that was you.
It was not me. It was Lipton.
It was.
All right, so cheers, everybody, and welcome to the Jolly Heretic. We are, of course, online public house. We meet on Mondays at 7 p.m. UK time, 2 p.m. New York, which discuss all kinds of interesting stuff that's going on in the news, from sort of psychological and increasingly literary and research into slavery perspective. So cheers, everybody. Cheers, Chin Chin, resident poet, Hurligan Gurligan, Kate Lipton. You definitely you got some window open. Kate Capis, Salu, Saludo, Proust, Prost, Slanger, Slangevar, and Turvy Sexy, and all that, and Capis, and Hurligan Gurligan.
Scrubbing on.
Yes, and
Yakidar.
Welcome to the Jolly Heretic. Listen, you don't seem to have your mansion background today. Why is that?
No, I don't, because I'm staying with a relative somewhere else in the UK. And I'm on my phone. I didn't bring my computer, so I'm on my phone.
Ah, okay. And that relative is a shouty.
But apart from that, you're very well prepared.
Yes, I am well prepared.
You've done well. Okay. Well,
Lipton, are you in Paul's cellar?
No, I'm not. There's a little baby beside
Darren,
me.
It's too well lit for my cellar.
Okay, fair enough.
It's too well lit, and he hasn't got a sort of a ball stuffed in his mouth. So he has the ability to speak. Hello, everybody, and I hope you've had an inspiring and interesting week. And hello. Now, we've got a number of things to talk about today. But the most significant that I would like to start with is the rise of Amelia. I don't think I've ever seen a campaign backfire so substantially. For those that aren't familiar with it, there was a computer game set up by a combination of Hull City Council and Prevent, in which you are a boy or girl, but you're they, them, either way, called Charlie, and you meet this purple-haired siren who wears a choker and wears purple and is very, very right wing. And she basically tries to get you into trouble. And if you follow her path of evil, then you have to go to a Prevent meeting, and then all your friends don't like you anymore. And you realize you need to be a good boy and not criticize immigration or anything that is government policy. It's basically a very intimidating game. And it's completely backfired because this character has now become the new Pepe the Frog, the new kind of hero of dissidents. So I'll start by Lipton. I really would be if they could either come on the stream or shut up. The first time I interviewed you, Lipton, many years ago, you were just in the kitchen of your shared apartment, and there was it was constant.
I don't think Lipton's ever been this articulate before.
No. This is true, Jamaican patois. Lipton, what do you think of if you could get the children to shut up and say what are your thoughts on the Amelia phenomenon, Lipton?
Well, interestingly, Ed, I was not paying any attention to this Amelia person, so I'm completely unaware as to what was taking place. I was too busy following those. Boy, go away.
It'll be all right on the night.
Did I just hear a frying pan hit a child's head?
Look, try and be serious and concentrate on the issue at hand. Remember the new agreement that we stick to the script and we're grown up here. Right, I'll go over to I don't know what's going on there. I'll go over to Paul or Darren, one of you.
Go to Paul.
Okay, Paul.
Yeah, this baby, he's gone now.
Right, but Lipton,
should I phone social services?
No.
You're going to get reported to prevent Lipton for that, I think. Have you just failed to defraud?
It's the way you said, they've gone.
Gone. No, back to this. Yeah, back to this. Amelia Lee, this Amelia character, she backfired. So today, interesting story. Today I was on a train and I was speaking to this lovely woman from Canada, really nice lady. And she said that she doesn't like the Reform Party. And once she had a dream that the Reform Party members were, you know, the Tory party members were encouraging her to vote for the Reform people. She said it was a nightmare.
Lipton, can I ask you two things? One is, did you say talking to woman or stalking?
Yeah, I find it really funny.
I think you said stalking. And secondly, have you ever, you've beaten your own record.
No, I was speaking to a lady, and she had a nightmare, yes.
Right, but Lipton, you've gone off topic in the first response to the topic.
Yeah, I'm going to leave it. Lipton, if you could just look up Amelia, please, professionally, while Paul talks. So, Paul, this Amelia thing, isn't it extraordinary how did this kind of thing happen in higher education a lot, that I don't know, that something can backfire so spectacularly, and the thing that you're meant to be frightened of and is evil becomes...
There are various phrases, reverse engineering, recuperation, co-optation, but basically it's such a stupid, manufactured... They're trying to be down with the kids, they're trying to be creative, and they've got all the creativity of your average county councillor. And guess what? The internet has many, many myriad legion faults, but one of the things it is on occasion incredibly creative. And they've just reverse engineered it, showed them up for the po-faced idiots they are. And it's very funny.
I like the level of detail as well. Like it's almost like projection, because you would expect a left-wing woman to dress like that, to have dyed purple hair. And they even give her a spot, like a mole on her face, which the other characters don't have, what you used to call, you know, a beauty spot, whatever, in the 18th century.
Yeah, I caught a bit of your video, Ed, where you did an impression of Freud, analysing it, if Freud had had a serious concussion.
Yes, thank you. I think that is quite reasonable. I mean, she's saying sex. She's saying short-term relationship. She's saying screw me. She's saying I'm high in openness. I'm a bit dangerous. I'm a bit I'm probably sexually promiscuous. I'm a bit crazy. I am. I'm a bit hot and I'm a bit crazy. Go for me. And I have extremely right-wing opinions. And obviously,
you were using a third person then. Sorry, I was getting excited. I'm sorry.
No. I was pretending that I was Amelia.
Right, got you.
In the thing. So this is the ultimate sexy thing, isn't it? That she's indicating that she's a fast, efficient strategist and basically a bit of a slut. And she has all your based opinions and stuff.
You had in your video, Ed, you had a whole thing about Holter and the symbolism and the psychoanalytical depth to that. How would you psychoanalyze the wearing of a cravat?
I sort of me as the kind of thing Desmond Morris would say, really, that you are doing the same thing. You are saying, look, you are daring.
You're vulnerable, but you're also...
I think it's Ralph Barth, isn't it? Ralph Barth says that you're daring someone to strangle you. You're saying, I dare you. Go on. I dare you to strangle me. So when men do it, it's like an assertion of power. You're daring them to strangle you. I think that's what Roland Barthes said. So I think that's why she's so erotically charged, and the purple hair and the indicating that she's a bit mental, a bit, you know, is part of it. Darren, did you have any thoughts on Amelia?
Well, I hadn't heard of Amelia until you sent me your message earlier, so I had a quick look. I'm wondering if you... Maybe tapping into something Paul said a moment ago. This is aimed at young people, and young people do tend to be rebellious by nature. So whenever they're presenting this Amelia as a villain, a bad person or whatever, you get a lot of young people, that sort of teenage oppositional defiance that they go through. And it really has just it's backfired. They're maybe siding with her as the good guy, if you know what I mean, rather than this is the villain, the person you should avoid.
Yeah, one thing I noticed as well is that Amelia was the only person whose pronouns were she, her. Everybody else in the game was they, them. Everybody else, even though you select to be a boy or a girl, Charlie, and even though your mum is in it, they are, and the teacher is obviously female. Everybody is they, them, except the evil Amelia. She's she, her. And I thought that was saying something pretty clear, which is that you're evil if you use the pronouns he and she, and a good person uses they, them. But yeah, it's obvious that any self-respecting child is going to, or teenager rather, is going to just A, want to rebel against that. B, there's evidence from Canada, by the way, that my friend Eric Kaufman has just published, that the youth are increasingly right-wing, even controlling for factors that would interfere with that, like sex. They are increasingly right-wing. So this is their new rebellion.
Well, I wonder, and I think this is interesting. I remember listening to Andrew Doyle was interviewed. It was probably about 2 years ago, maybe 3 years ago by now. But he was saying that the way out of this, the way the madness that we were going through, he believed it was going to be the young people. It was going to be the kids, because kids do tend to rebel against whatever the adults are trying to instill into them, trying to dictate to them. And I wonder, is what we're seeing with Amelia just that manifest, that happening?
It's true, but there's a slight complication, isn't there? Because they can rebel in two directions.
Mm-hmm.
So it can either be, we are in a left-wing society and it's not left-wing enough. We will be even more ridiculously left-wing and you know, trans and skincare and all that. That's our rebellion. is that really a rebellion? Or it's the, you know, the opposing it, the being right wing when it's left wing and being left wing when it's right wing. It's interesting because those people that are the most that probably see themselves as rebellious by dyeing their hair green and getting tattoos, and they probably see themselves as rebellious, but I don't think they are. They're in many ways uber conformist.
Yeah, that, I think you're right. Sorry, did I interrupt someone? Sorry,
you can go ahead, Darren. I was about to speak, but you can go ahead.
No, you go ahead, Lepton.
No, like young people who support climate alarmism and they talk about renewable energy, those young people are not being radical. They're conforming to the orthodoxy, but they assume that they're being radical. They think that they're fighting big capitalism when in reality, entrepreneurs benefit from renewable energy subsidies. So they're just a puppet of the capitalist class, but they don't know any better.
Lipton, could you speak up? I can't hear you.
Yeah, Lipton, it's very quiet.
I don't know. Are you able to hear me now?
Yeah, just about.
Okay. No, I was saying that climate alarmism is driven by young people, and they assume that they're radical, but they're really conservative because entrepreneurs benefit from renewable energy subsidies. So these young people who promote climate alarmism are really enriching the capitalist class. And again, Paul is laughing, Darren is laughing. What's going on?
They are wagging you. You're very loud. They're being sarcastic.
I didn't catch a word the first time around, so thank God you repeated that. Yeah, exactly. This is also, I think that Lipton's downloaded the Make Your Voice Even More Jamaican app, which is he has this app on his phone but not on his laptop, and it makes the accent more pronounced. But no, that's the thing, that these people, like in these people now then that are the climate alarmist people are really the equivalent of the kind of Billy Graham rally people in the 50s, and who were saying to religious conservative mum and dad, you're not religious and conservative enough. But it's reversed. So that's the thing about rebellion. Mm.
But it's not just demographics within a population, it's also across cultures. So the millenarians, you know, the turn of the 1000 AD, there were loads of nutters proclaiming the end of the world, Ed Miliband-like. Don't you think it goes in cycles, meme-like cultural cycles?
Of millenarianism.
Yeah, and just eschatological nut jobs.
Yeah, I think you might be right about that, and that is consistent with the theory of my Finnish friend Jani Miettinen, who argues that there are four generational hormone cycles, and you're going to get a bonkers generation every four generations. That is convinced that everything's going to fall apart. It won't actually fall apart as badly as they think. That it might fall apart a bit. And there has to be a massive war every four generations. And we're now at that stage where that generation that thinks like that is the youngish generation. That is the theory. And this pushes towards craziness. Whereas the generation of like Paul's generation was just laid back and funky. It was just get on, just go to university, have a laugh, get paid £18 an hour to do tutorials that I also got paid £18 an hour to do 20 years later. And just enjoy stuff. There was corporal punishment, but not that bad.
Not enough.
Not enough. Certainly not enough. So that's why Paul's so badly behaved even now. Not enough.
Eddie, I am trying to speak. I know you are fascinated by this Amelia character. I know. And you guys are still laughing, so obviously there is an issue. But instead of talking about Amelia, why don't we talk about this story that was popular over the weekend? That black influencer who was reading out aloud and looking at the meaning of different words. That's not a popular story.
No, a popular story was that there was a black influencer who was on the BBC News, and he said to Geeta Guru Murphy, who was a South Asian newsreader that's related to Kristen Guru Murphy, that his favourite person was Jesus Christ.
Jesus!
Exactly, right?
Oh, yes, I saw that.
And she went, yeah. Like that.
I'm a snake charmer, Darren.
Yeah. He's got a little snake there.
Okay.
I've never been bitten. The power of the Lord protects me.
I went to a snake handling church in Tennessee, and this guy told me that he'd been bitten twice, but that on the two occasions he'd been bitten, he wasn't sure that the Holy Spirit wanted him to handle the snakes. So that's why he got bitten.
And he didn't die, so the Holy Spirit protected him.
The Holy Spirit did protect him on those two occasions. Yes, he lost the use of one of his fingers in one instance, and he was bitten on the back of the head in the other instance, but not enough poison went in. But he was okay. But when I asked him about why it was that his best friend, because I had been aiming to go to the snake handling church in Jolo, Kentucky, and then I had to change my plans because the pastor was bitten to death by snakes. And I asked him, I said, did you know this guy? He goes, yeah, he was my best friend. And I said, well, why did he get killed then? Oh, well, it's just his time. It wasn't to do with the Holy Spirit. It was just that was meant to be. That was still very good.
Darren told me at the university you experimented with trouser snakes.
A Finnish doctor did once advise me, because it's happened to a friend of mine as well in Finland, not just me, was it's so cold that it affects your winkle. And he advised putting a sock on your winkle within your pants. Keep it in your pants.
Don't go flashing in Finland in the middle of winter would be my advice.
That reminds me of that joke. It's nice out, isn't it? Yeah, I think I'll get mine out as well. But anyway... Look, we're moving off topic here, so let's move back onto topic. The Geeta Guru Murphy hissing thing, Paul.
Atrocious.
Bias. I've been appalling. Is Geeta Guru Murphy the Antichrist?
It was a beautiful moment in a way because it was so spontaneous. She could not deny that was her spontaneous actual reaction. You can try and finesse these things away with sound bites later on. But her instinctive reaction was to suck in breath. And I don't know what the crass Darwinist explanation is for sucking in breath like that, but I'm sure I'm about to hear. Go on.
Well, it's a sort of fear and discomfort, isn't it? So that's why you were sucking breath like that. And she tried to say, "Oh, I was taking a breath because I was about to move on to the next section." No, you weren't. You just asked him a question. You asked him a question, and you expected a reasonably substantive answer. And he gave you. He wasn't even finished his answer. He hadn't finished his answer, and you reacted like that because you found it so offensive and scary. And incongruous with your expectations that he should say that his favourite person was JC, which in a supposedly Christian country should be all our favourite persons. So I it just shows you the bias of the BBC. Darren, what do you think?
Well, again, I watched the clip earlier prior to coming on because I hadn't seen it. It's a difficult one. Was she doing what she claimed she was doing? Because if that's the case, that sharp intake of breath, that are there other clips where she's interviewing people and she does the same thing?
No, is the answer.
If not, well, there you go. Then maybe it was some kind of discomfort that came up in her.
Exactly. I can't imagine someone saying, "Yeah, my favourite person is Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him." And I'm going, "Ooh, that's very bad. That's no." But she did with that, so she was uncomfortable with it, and she couldn't help herself. That's the wonderful thing about it. It was unconscious. She couldn't help herself. It's like it's like some ugly woman walks in through and you go, "Oh God, oh sorry." Yeah, or yawning when you're bored and you're watching a speech and you yawn and the speaker sees you yawn. You can't deny that you are bored. If you were remotely interested in the speech, you wouldn't yawn. So it's unconscious. So it's beautiful. What do you think, Lipton, about that?
Oh, I don't know why she responded with such fury, because left-wingers like to repackage Jesus Christ as a socialist. So I'm really bothered by her response. I don't know why she responded like that. Whenever we're talking about Jesus Christ in the public space, he's often perceived to be a kind, gentle person. He's egalitarian, and we're living in the egalitarian zeitgeist. So I don't know why she reacted the way she did.
Yeah, well, he also says things like that, you know, you have to follow him or you go to hell. He does say that.
Could I also add, I don't think in that, I got dressed up that she was somehow being demonic. It was a demonic sound. I think it was just the absolute encapsulation of BBC incestuous insularity. But related to that, you know, in my spare time now, I watch a lot of YouTube videos of ICE protesters being beaten up. It relaxes me. Yeah. And one of them, she kicked a state trooper. She punched a state trooper and then tried to kick another one. And she was thrust onto the bonnet of a Range Rover or whatever, a 4x4. And she had a demonic face on her. And there's something about the ICE protests, the counter-ICE protests were... I know I'm not an original insight, but there is something absolutely psychologically deranged about what's going on.
On both ends, though, because Candace Owens is now saying that the ghost of Charlie Kirk is communicating with her.
Well, that's not, that's not a fair comparison. Candace Owens is certifiably insane.
Yes.
So, citing, I'm talking about members of the public.
Oh, yeah. But no, there is something...
Yeah, but there's so many of them on the streets now.
Well, I agree with you. The one that got herself killed, this Renee Nicole Good, she's obviously... Obviously, if you look into her histories, we talked about it last week when I read her poem, but like she's obviously got like identity disturbance. She's gone from being a radical fundamentalist Christian that goes to Northern Ireland to preach the word to the Northern Irish, who are already quite religious, by the way, to being a fervent atheist, rejecting it all and whatever. And then there's the look on her face, when the look of sort of weird, sort of dissociated arrogance on her face before she then drove her car into that ice person they're not well.
Ed,
yes,
you know what's going on, Ed. That's why more people should read your book, Woke Eugenics. They're spiteful mutants.
Yes, they are spiteful mutants. No, I concur entirely. They are spiteful mutants. Although it's not just mutation, though. That's the thing. How can you know? It's also, I think, a maladaptive environment, which tells them all the wrong things, tells them all the wrong things to do and all the wrong things to think. And they
the point I'm trying to make, Ed, is in the past, right until relatively recently, I would always have thought of what's going on as a political disagreement. And because you don't want to label people insane, because that's just a shortcut and it's avoiding having a constructive debate. But the spirit has taken Lipton away. What we're seeing now actually just strikes me, you know, Darren's more involved in the psychological side of things than either you or I, but it just strikes me as there's manifest evidence of absolute patent mental illness.
Yes, and that's consistent with the studies that like 50% of these women that are under the age of 30 that are involved in the far left have mental illness of some kind, normally cluster B personality problems. And there was a march, was even today somewhere in France, with these women bare-breasted marching along with slogans on. Well, it's just histrionic behavior. You're just drawing attention to yourself. Listen to me, shut up, or I will condemn you. Scream, 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 scream. It's what we used to call hysteria. It's what Freud would have called hysteria. And but we don't do anything about it. We just let them behave like this. Like, I remember seeing this instance of years ago of these police officers that approached a left-wing female president. She just started screaming, just screaming, until they went away.
But it's worse than that, Ed, because at least in Freud's time, you were treated as ill and you were forced to go on the orgasmatron or whatever treatment they gave you. Now it's socially sanctioned and valued by some people.
Yes, this idea that you can say that I'm so passionate about my cause that and those disagreeing with my righteous cause that I can't control my emotions.
Mm.
No, you control your emotions or you should be birched. It's like... No, that surely the one thing that you teach, you should be teaching children and you should be teaching everybody, is that you control, keep it in the pants, right? Keep it under control. It's a serious problem if you're not taught to do that. I was reading, I don't know, it's off topic a little bit, obviously, but I was reading Sinead O'Connor's autobiography the other day. And I thought, what's the matter with this woman? A, she's obviously exaggerating the extent to which she was abused as a child, and she's obviously lying, and the things that she says don't make any sense. And B, she seems to think she can just behave however she wants, just do whatever she wants. She was crazy, brilliant singer and songwriter and whatever, but insane. Darren, what do you think?
I wonder. The world has changed very, very quickly, and I don't think it's an accident when you think of the lockdown and isolation and so on. I did a piece of work looking at different kinds of trolls, trolling behaviours, stalking behaviours, the incel culture and so on. And when I was looking at some of the research behind it, what I found really interesting was a recurring theme, and that was loneliness and a lack of connection.
You've got some screen open, Darren, which is causing possibly.
Let me have a look. The only screen I have open,
causing possibly.
Let me have a look.
The only screen I have open.
Yeah. It's called a feedback loop. You must have. This has happened earlier in the thing, and people are now LMAOing, and you know we're in serious trouble.
What's going on? You know, serious trouble.
No, honestly, the only screen I have open is this one, so I'm not really. I'll tell you what I'll try to do. I'll tell you what I'll try to do.
Clearly, there's something wrong.
It could be the metal plate in my head causing interference.
Yeah, I'm going to remove you from the studio until you do that. Right. No, still do it. Right, it was Lipton.
It was always Lipton.
Back,
if in doubt, it was Lipton.
Darren, hello?
Lipton. Hello.
It's Lipton's fault. Right, okay. Sorry about that. What were you going to say about loneliness?
Oh, yeah. Loneliness has when loneliness becomes chronic, whenever there's a disconnection, different things can get disconnected. Trauma can disconnect us. Addiction can disconnect us. What did I miss?
Sorry, Lipton appeared. There was a momentary feedback loop, and then he disappeared again.
Well, I removed him because I realised I put Lipton, there'd be a feedback loop.
Oh,
so okay. Sort out your feedback loop, and then I will put you back in like 5 minutes. Right, Darren.
The things can disconnect us, can create loneliness. Things like addiction, things like mental health problems, things like even the lot. If you think of the lockdown, a couple of years of the only connection you had was really through social media or whatever. And long-term chronic loneliness, we're not just talking about feeling sad and longing for company. It can open people up. It makes them more susceptible to being radicalized and things like that. It can, people are yearning for some kind of connection, so they might join some kind of a group or whatever it is. And then when they meet a lot of like-minded people, what you do is you get some kind of connection, but it's often like a surface-level connection. In other words, there's no real deep, meaningful kind of friendships or whatever, but they feel as if they belong to something. And I'm just wondering, it could that be one of the factors behind what you see in the like the polarization of the world today?
Could I ask a direct question that's relevant to that? Because going back to lockdown, which you mentioned, everyone blames that. Here we go. And I live in a rural area, so when lockdown happened, my life actually changed for the worse only because I got to see more people, because all these weekend wankers arrived in their 4x4s to get out in the countryside, whereas I live quite a misanthropic, completely separate life. So I actually saw more people. And my question would be, there's a certain extent to which loneliness is self-manufactured because you have no internal resources. You can't stand your own company. So you're desperate to speak to other people. I'm desperate to avoid people most of the time. And look how well-adjusted I am. So I do think this notion of loneliness, it can be interpreted in different ways. Mm-hmm. And I think I get your point, because I think one of the issues is there's too much superficial reinforcement. There are too many social connections of an incredibly shallow nature, and these people have no real social connection. So on the one hand, it's too much connection, but it's of the wrong type.
Mm.
Whereas I have a select number of people in my basement that I'm happy with, that it works for me, and everyone's a winner.
And Ed is one of them.
I'm going to try and get Lipton in again.
Yes, I am back now. Darren, interesting opinion as usual, but recently I was reading the conversation and the professor was arguing that the loneliness myth it is overrated. And I tend to agree with him because usually, why are you laughing, Ed?
It's very, very loud.
Well, let me continue to speak.
Regardless of what they're doing, I'm listening. Please go ahead.
Exactly. So, Darren, usually I'm either doing professional work, reading, or sitting down alone and contemplating. And I'm not lonely. I'm okay. I wouldn't say that I dislike people to the degree that Paul dislikes them, but I like to be alone. I'm really introverted. And when I join a group, it's because I want to add intellectual value. I'm not looking for social connections. I just want to use the group as a platform to proliferate my ideas. So I'm not exactly disagreeing with what you're saying, but why are some people so inclined to become radical because they are alone?
Because they have no inner resources.
Yeah, and loneliness isn't just about the company we can, the number of friends we have.
You can't do this, you can't go on like this. You can't get your phone or something. Oh, God. Oh, it's hell.
Can I just ask, where's Richard? Why could he not be here doing this instead?
Richard's been complicated. It's like It's like in Iron Maiden. If it's the band Iron Maiden, okay, I'm Steve Harris. I'm the one that's reliable and it's always there. And then Michael Woodley, he's like Paul Di'Anno or something. And then
Who am I, Ed?
You'd be maybe Adrian Smith.
And what's he?
He's a guitarist. And then Lipton, he'd be maybe like the drummer Nico McBrain. No, Paul's like Nico McBrain, the drummer. Yeah, that's what Paul is. And then Lipton maybe is Adrian Smith. But that's currently the situation with Richard. He's being fussy. I'd love to have it. But yes, the loneliness issue. I suppose. Do we have more? Are friendships more superficial than they used to be? I mean, we used to have absolutely nothing.
It's the level of connection. Just to go back to something that Lipton had said a moment ago, loneliness isn't always about the number of people we have around us, because we could have hundreds around us, and they're all just kind of superficial. We all maybe just support the same football team or whatever, and whatever, you know, there's no real depth to it. We can have different kinds of connection, and going back to what you were saying a moment ago about the lockdown, for what it's worth, I like you, Paul, I live in the middle of nowhere. Okay, so I like to have my own space as well. But we need to be human beings need to be stimulated in different ways, emotionally, intellectually, physically, and so on. And during the lockdown for about 2 years or something, there was pretty much none of that, unless it was like this over Zoom or something. It's not always the amount of connection, it's the depth of the connection, it's the type of the connection. So even Lipton joining a group, he feels a part of something. He's contributing to something. And that's what I mean by connection. Without that, that's where the loneliness can take hold. That's where over a long period of time, people can become suggestible. They can become open to being radicalized. You'll see them on online forums and things. And I was looking at the incel culture. I thought it was interesting. I was watching interviews with people who had been in that. And what they had found is when they were in those groups, they had connection. They had shared ideas. They had similar experiences. But then one of them had said that he had met someone, he had got talking to her, and he had arranged a date. And as soon as he said that, it's like the whole group, like a cult kind of mentality, the whole group ostracized him. For having a date. So he's faced with this choice. Does he have this date with someone where he can maybe build a real relationship with some kind of a depth to it? Or does he stick with this group of people he's probably never met from different corners of the world?
Right. Whose identity is based around being together in their loserishness.
Yeah. And, you know, in this guy's story anyway, he chose the real. He chose to try to build a relationship with someone. He went on a few dates and so on. But that whole group completely ostracized him. Now, there might be other people who join various groups to get involved in various movements and so on. But it's very, very difficult to try to get away from that if you feel, as you mentioned, Ed, your whole identity is based on it. It's based within that little group.
Yeah, within that little group. That's basically a kind of maladaptive coping mechanism, really. Mm.
There is, for some people, even though they are superficial and they are shallow and it's all based on their own shared experience and ideas and so on, there is still a sense of belonging.
Yeah, but there's also the friction element. So if I can use immunity as a metaphor, you build up immunity by encountering germs. And it's like if you live in a meat space, if you live in the real world, you have to rub shoulders with people you don't like.
Yeah.
Now, the problem is all the things we're talking about, the anti-ICE protesters and so on, come from groups that just mutually reinforce each other's hysteria. So more than ever before in history, the hysteria has no, it really isn't a Lipton-like echo chamber.
And also, it's one way, isn't it? Like I don't get triggered emotionally when left-wing people express their views to me. They get, I just like, right, okay, yeah. They get triggered emotionally when I express my views to them. So it's a one way problem that you can't possibly think that.
And Ed, when we met up in Liverpool, it was quite enjoyable, wasn't it? Because we actively disliked each other much more in person.
Yeah.
And that was meaningful. That meant something.
It meant something. It made life like a drama. I felt alive because
It was no longer a superficial dislike. We were mutually invested in.
And there was the real possibility of violence.
Yeah.
And I liked that. It made me feel alive. It was my evolutionary match. To feel that seriously it could kick off. But it didn't, because Richard.
Luckily, because we both ignored Darren, who was trying to cause a fight at the time.
Oh, you mean the first time we met? Oh, right. I think the second time we met. But Darren. Well, Darren was
at dinner. He was goading us, wasn't he? He was saying, he kept telling me things you'd said that you'd never said.
It was that divorce coach woman. She was goading us.
Oh, God.
She was stirring it up. That was good fun. Anyway, we're about halfway through. So those that knew, hello. And I think Lipton's just buggered off. I think he realised he can't work.
Sorry to interrupt before you begin, but there was a consistency to Lipton's performance this week. Every single opportunity, whether a child or whether an echo or whether an overly loud microphone, there was just constant noise effects. I was very impressed.
It's like he planned it.
It was like a symphonic... a symphony of audio aberrations. It was brilliant.
Yes, it was very good. It was very good. What's that pub I like in Liverpool? What's it called? The
Philharmonic.
Philharmonic. Yeah, Philharmonic. That's the word.
That is a really nice pub. Definitely.
It was good.
Ed, have you seen Paul's video on that pub?
Yes, I have.
It's very good.
Oh,
if you ever find yourself in Belfast, do a similar video on the Crown Bar.
I will. I've been to Belfast once, but it was only for the day.
I met
a taxi driver who complained about the troubles that ended, and he said the traffic was a lot worse. He was a very funny bloke. He was my cup of tea. I asked him, I said, you must be really glad the troubles were over, and he's like, no.
There's a story Billy Connolly told when he was doing a gig in Belfast. And he said he was just wandering through Belfast, having a look at the city centre, and he passed this shop. He couldn't take his eyes off. There was a sale on bomber jackets. This is priceless. This is brilliant.
I just love that. I just love that shop on the Shankill. On the Shankill, and all it sells is unionist provocative stuff. And I always imagine him getting his bank loan and so what's your idea? I want to sell provocative unionist stuff to piss off the tags, and that's an excellent idea. Yes, so I can certainly give you this loan.
Before you go any further, just one more thing. I used to work in this place over in East Belfast, and on a Friday we would all get our lunch out at this the local chippy, and it was called For Cod and Ulster. It was great.
That is good. And I bet it was cash only as well, as many places
on delivery.
Funny you should say that, yeah.
And they still have Golden Wonder crisps in Northern Ireland. You can't get anywhere else. Right. So we're about halfway through, unless I get interrupted again. No. So those that hello. Joy Heritage, those of you, would you please subscribe? You subscribe here on YouTube, you can subscribe on my Substack, which is jollyheretic.com, where I put all the most base stuff, in-person interviews, blogs, films I make, my digest I do once a week. Where if you like what I do, you can support me with the cost of just a pint of beer a month. Next to me, we have Dr. Paul Taylor, Quality Learning Center. He's alluding to the old Somali. The old Somali people there. So could you subscribe to his channel? That's Readers of the Lost Art, where, as you heard, he has his discussion of the Philharmonic in Liverpool.
Sorry to interrupt, Ed, but could I say a thank you? Because I'm not normally nice to your followers, but when I begged and pleaded last week to try and get to my 6,000, I'm not there yet, but I got about 60 people subscribed after last week's performance. And normally when I come on here, my subscribers go down, not up. I'd just like to say a genuine thank you to all your followers who don't normally like me but subscribed anyway.
Yes, someone actually emailed me to explain to me how that he watched that that debate we did at the studio, and he said that how offensive Paul was, and what an awful man he is, and I actually said, yeah, he's a friend of mine, and I live stream him once a week. And the guy emailed back and said, "Oh, sorry, I hope I wasn't talking out of turn about Paul." I said, "Don't worry, he's a very difficult man." So there you go. So then we have Darren McGee, Darren F. McGee, I believe. What's the F for, Francis?
No, it's Foy.
Right.
Had you lied? You said it was fuckwit.
No.
cheeky little wind up scamster, you.
It's Foy, so it's probably his mother's maiden name or something. But anyway, there you
Absolutely.
Go.
Absolutely, yeah, that was a good guess. Yeah, it was my mother's maiden name.
Okay, and so they are, I guess the Foys must be a sort of aristocratic family in Northern Ireland, and they thought they'd keep
Actually, no, the Foys came from Liverpool. My granddad was stationed in Belfast during the war, that's where he met my gran.
Well, that's odd, because normally the direction of travel is the opposite way, isn't it?
Well, initially, when they did get married, they did go back to Liverpool. That's where my my uncle and my mother were born. But then they came back to Belfast at some point during the 50s, and they stayed here.
All right.
I like Belfast. I like Northern Ireland in general. I like Northern Ireland in general, except there was that town I went to that wasn't very nice. What was it called? Now, there was a bombing. There was a murder. What was it called, that town? That was very nice.
That really narrows it down.
I was going to say, Ed, narrow it down. Why don't you?
It'll come to me. Okay, so... anyway,
Enniskillen.
No, it wasn't Enniskillen. I wanted to go there.
Keep naming places, Darren. It really winds
it's really divided between Catholic and Protestant. No, I'm not going to remember it now. It's too late.
No, but if you don't remember it, Ed, if you don't remember it, then the whole program's ruined. You need to remember
it. There was a park in the centre of this town where there was a massacre or something in the 70s. Anyway, look, that's by the by.
Well, that's going to bother me for the rest of the show, Ed.
Yeah, it was, what's the place where there's the nuclear power station in the UK? It sounds like that, in Kent.
Sellafield?
No, in Kent.
Okay,
anyway, never mind. Look, I'll look it up while Paul's talking later. Right. So we have a resident poet here at the Jolly Heretic Public House, Mr. Quinn, and he has sent in the following poem for our dedication and delight. This government's feeling so tired, its video game has backfired. One has to admit, Amelia's a hit, a lady who's widely admired. Thank you very much, Mr. Quinn. So if you please subscribe to Mr. Quinn's channel, that's the resident poet, Jolly Heretic. And he has a book of Jolly Heretic poetry, which is, of course, available on the old Amazon. Now, we've been sent in, before we move on to the other things I have on the list, we've been sent in some super chats. So the first is from Chris Mack, and he says, lots of noise in a black household. No, couldn't be. That's very good, Mr. Mack. Well done on your sensitivity there. And lack of stereotyping, but yeah, Lipton, he's just buggered off completely. I hope we haven't hurt his feelings, but it was very noisy.
I didn't know Lipton was on Twitter.
Yeah, Lipton is on Twitter. He's not particularly active on Twitter, but he is on Twitter.
Well, neither am I.
You're obviously not very active on Twitter because you haven't heard of Amelia. If you were active on Twitter, you would have heard of you hadn't heard of Amelia or the Gita Guru Murphy thing. I'm wondering if you've heard of Eva Vladenbruck, Greenland, Robert Jenrick, or the concept of obesity. Because those are the other things I've got listed here.
I know the name Robert Jenrick. The other one, no, I'm drawing a blank.
Andrew Rossendale, I believe his name is. The MP for Romford. Okay, Alexander P3Z says, token of appreciation. From Norway. Thank you very much, people from Norway. Tusen takk to you.
Did they give you a lot, Ed? Because they're dripping in their social fund, oil-funded social fund, aren't they?
He gave me 20 Norwegian kroner. I have no idea what that is. I don't know if that's a lot. I don't really know. And then he gives me 100 Norwegian kroner, which implies 20 might not be that much. And he says, just a superficial super chat. Thank you very much, Mr. Alexander P3Z from Norway. And someone got in touch with me from Norway recently and said if I'm ever in Oslo, they'd like to buy me a drink, a beer, which is a significant investment, isn't it? Because a beer in Oslo is very, very expensive. Okay, Ebbe Vladingerbrook, we want to talk about that. Or should we know? Let's talk about fat, because Paul sent me that issue. So, Paul, the obesity issue, we were going to talk about
Did you manage to see it, or did you do a Lipton and not do your homework?
No, I actually did my homework. I did my homework on this.
Well, anyway, Darren, it was I don't always like him, but Matt Walsh, the American influencer, he did a video on... They show, and this is a shame Lipton's not here, because on The View, Oprah Winfrey was interviewed, and she said that in the past, she's now on weight loss drugs, but in the past she was obese, not because she ate too much, but because she had the obesity gene. And Matt Walsh did a very funny 10-minute segment about the reverse logic that you could apply in lots of different instances. So, you punch me. What do you say? I'm falling. Can you remember any of the examples, Ed, of the reverse logic?
Well, the reverse logic is you know, I'm what was it? Yeah, she was saying that I'm fat because I'm, what was the argument? I'm fat because I'm obese. I'm not. What was it? I eat too much because I'm obese. I'm not obese because I eat too much. Yeah, that was the reverse logic. And so then, it was saying, you know, I can't remember any examples of it, but it doesn't make any sense. Well, it kind of does, but you have to know a bit about a certain hypothesis. But it's extraordinary. I eat too much because I'm obese. Doesn't make any sense, does it? I mean, to be obese is a specific BMI. So.
And she said that it's an obesity gene. So I don't know anything about this, Ed. Is there an obesity gene?
There is a theory that what obesity is the putting on of a specific kind of fat, adipose fat. And once you start putting on adipose fat, then you very easily put on more fat. And this is genetic. Obesity is something like 0.6 heritable. I.e. to do with genes. So there is the genetics. Some people are more likely to get fat, right? The counter argument is, well, you know, you're more likely to get fat, so eat less. But the counter argument is that there's more to it than that, and that these people can eat the same amount as anyone else. They will get fat. They'll get fat very easily. And the suggestion is that it's to do with obstetrics. So until about 1930, when there wasn't obstetrics, the percentage of women, did I write the statistics down somewhere? I don't know where I wrote them down. But the percentage of women here we go, adipose tissue. So in 1930, there was 10% child mortality, and 14% of the offspring of these women that were died in childbirth would also die. But 60% of women that were predisposed to obesity would die in childbirth, or who were fat would die in childbirth, and 56% of their children would die after, you know, not long afterwards. So then what we're dealing with is a genetic change whereby before obstetrics, women that were fat or had the propensity in the absence of lots of food to be fat would die in childbirth. And so this has stopped happening. Nobody dies in childbirth anymore. Child mortality rate is less than 1%. So therefore, for genetic reasons, since 1930, there has been a rise in obesity. And so if 1,000 alleles are associated with BMI, and a 5% shift moves from 25% to 30% obese, then you can see that there's a genetic component to this. And so in reality, then, these people, like Oprah, potentially have a propensity to be obese.
Yeah, but the key thing there is propensity, isn't it? I have a propensity to get very angry very quickly, but I make sure I never indulge that, and it never happens. So shouldn't people take some responsibility?
Yep, that's true. So some people just know, some people just need to understand basically that food is their enemy. some people can eat as much food as they like, and they have a quick metabolism, and they'll digest it and whatever. Those people are not very famine resistant, and those people will be like in North Korea. There were studies on this. The first people to die were tall people because they need more food, and athletic people because they digest food very quickly and whatever, and they maintain muscle, not fat. And so those people would die.
That's an extreme end of the spectrum, isn't it? Whereas in everyday life, I totally accept there can be a genetic component. But I really resist this idea, because there's a genetic component to something, you're absolved of all responsibility. So if you've got a genetic component, you're going to be fatter, but it doesn't mean that whatever happens, you are fated to be morbidly obese.
No, that's true. Porter Down was the name of the town.
Oh, got there in the end.
Porter Down.
What's that going to do, the nuclear reactor?
For some reason, it reminds me of, I don't know, it just puts me
what in was mind. It? Sorry, what was it you said you didn't like about it, Ed? You thought the people weren't that friendly?
No, they were very friendly. Everyone's very friendly in Northern Ireland always. Often overly friendly. I mean, they do things like stroke your face. But I mean, that literally happened to me in a pub in Larne.
What parts of Northern Ireland are you going to? Where, whose house are you going to?
I was at a pub in Larne.
Admittedly, Darren, it was a knocking shop he was in at the time.
It was a pub in Larne, and I said to this guy, well, which way do I drive around to get? And he goes, oh, stay on the very stroke. You stroke the face, it is. And then another guy.
But you have an oil of Ulay face, Ed. I want to stroke your face, and I'm the most heterosexual man in existence.
They are very, very tactile people, the Northern Irish.
But you have a preternaturally shiny, oily face.
You just wait to see it was real. He just wanted to feel it was real. This guy that was an ex member of the he was kneecapped for not letting his son join the IRA, and his name was Philip, and then his best friend was an ex member of the UVF, and they were drinking together in this pub in Larne, which I thought was nice.
Larne is quite a distance from Portadown, though.
Yeah, but me and my friends were touring Northern Ireland.
Oh,
we got a car. We flew to Belfast, did Belfast, Larne, Porter Down, and someplace on the Irish border that I can't remember the name.
Anyway, you're doing a Lipton, Ed. You're going off topic. Fat is not fate, is what I'm suggesting.
That's true. So you're going to get some people that get angry very easily, and they have to, I don't know, come up with mechanisms to not do so, like, I don't know, beat their wives up or something. Or not beat their wives up, as the case may be, and they will go count to 10 or whatever, you know, I don't know, whatever you do, and then you get some people that are phlegmatic and don't get angry very easily, but maybe they have some other area of life that they have to try and come up with mechanisms to deal with. And so it's certainly true that if you have that propensity to obesity, it will be a struggle to not get fat, because you'll just eat normal amounts of food. For what would be for most people normal amounts of food, and you will get fat much more easily. On the plus side, of course, you're good in a famine situation, which is why the propensity has stayed in the population.
One of your OCD friends in the comments is complaining this was never the topic, but it was on the list. So
no, it is on the list.
Thank you. So scrub your nan, whoever was complaining.
Yeah, I put the main topic as Amelia, because I thought that was the most interesting and newsworthy thing to kind of draw people in like a moth to a kind of purple-haired flame.
But it does surprise me that one of your followers might get discombobulated by going ever so slightly off the advertised stated topic.
No, he must be a new follower, whoever that follower is, because we do tend to use the topic as a launch pad for banter, or interesting discussions. So in that regard,
I ask Darren, Ed, either of you, do you have a view, you know, this is Zempic and others of a similar type, would we all agree that there's nothing free in life, and if you take the Zempic and it has short-term benefits, Sod's law says there's got to be some long-term price you're going to pay. Like, I'm convinced in 10 20 years time they'll have a spate of pancreatic cancer or, you know, some type of response, because it's such a relatively untested drug.
Well, I don't know enough about it to be able to comment on it, but I would agree there is highly likely there's maybe some kind of side effect, possibly some maybe side effect for long term use even, but I don't know enough about it to be able to comment on it. Sorry.
Well, the other thing I do know about it is that it works by diminishing your appetite. It does. You just lose interest in food. And maybe I'm sharing too much, but surely food is one of the great pleasures in life. The idea that you lose weight by denying yourself one of the reasons for being alive strikes me as a bit of a Pyrrhic victory.
Yeah, I think with most drugs, because you're interfering with the body's natural chemistry, there are side effects. So the side effects everyone knows about, like the side effects of things like antidepressants, people put on weight, things like that. And the side effects of there's bound to be side. And also, I think there's a danger. Well, they talk about flu jabs. Oh, let's get a flu jab. Right. Well, so what you're doing then, when you're talking earlier, Paul, about, you know, getting used to bad things, and you gave the comparison of illness and getting used to viruses and that sort of thing. Well, if you take a flu jab, then the flu is evolving every year. It's changing every year. And your body is not getting used to the flu. Your body just has this flu jab, which means it's not getting used to necessarily in quite the right way the flu that is evolving over time. Whereas if you didn't have the flu jab, then you would be gradually getting used to it and building up a natural immunity. So one day when for some reason you can't get a jab because the medical services stop working, then you'll be in trouble. And so I think that this is a problem with this. It's bound to be. There's bound to be a side effect. This is Ozempic. There's bound to be.
But someone just said in the comments, just be thankful you don't need the drugs. But that's begging the question. The question is, does anyone actually medically need the drugs in an existential sense, or do they need the drugs because they lack the self-control?
They don't need the drugs. Like this guy Robert Jenrick apparently had Ozempic. He wasn't even fat. He just went from being sort of normal looking to being thin.
And well, let's just, but that's, again, that's not a great example in the sense that that's just odd. But let's say you are a morbidly obese person. I question the idea that no morbidly obese person can become non-morbidly obese through effort. I've never heard it as a terminal diagnosis, morbid obesity.
I get the impression from, I can only talk about a friend of mine who had a gastric band. And she was extrovert, which, by the way, predicts obesity. And fun, and I don't know, she just couldn't, it was almost like it was just an addiction. She couldn't stop herself from eating.
And again, but devil's advocate, can I ask you about the addiction? Because the addiction element is, I've heard it's often referred to addiction as a disease. No. And I'm sure it's a contrarian position, but whenever I hear people describe addiction as a disease, it begs the question.
Oh, it's lack of impulse control. At my 20th birthday party, she sat opposite me, this friend, and she was like grabbing my chips. And I said, "What do you think you're doing?" She said, "Oh, you know, you weren't quick enough." So that's the level of addiction that you see food and you just eat it. And I assume it was some sort of crutch when she was younger. I don't know, some neuroticism, and so she just used food, and then it just became out of control. And then once it's so out of control, it was like, what can you do? You can't lose weight in any normal way. And then if she did lose weight, she'd put it back on again.
I think, Paul, it is often referred to a disease, but a mentor I had many years ago was an addictions therapist and provided a lot of my training. He said that it's a term that's often misunderstood, that it's better to think of it in its original nature. I'm losing the thread of my thought here. It was referred to as a dis-ease, not a disease. There is a dis-ease with something, and whatever someone is taking, or whatever it is they're doing, could be for a variety of reasons. It's either numbing something, it's trying to escape something, but ultimately, whatever it is someone's doing now, unless it's like, you know, some chemical addiction like drugs and things like that, where there's something different going on, it's the brain becomes dependent on the very thing that's given it a hit, that's given it a little dopamine hit, that's given it an escape from something, that's numbing something. The brain becomes dependent on that, which is why commonly someone could maybe quit drinking, but they take up gambling, or they stop gambling, they start watching porn.
But anyway, sorry, Carol.
I missed what you said. Sorry.
I just said I could quit drinking anytime I want, but I don't want to. So.
Okay, fair enough. But it's more like a disease, because the brain becomes accustomed to the very thing that's given it a hit. Then it becomes dependent on the hit, so it's constantly looking for something. For some people, that might be food. But 15 years ago, my GP told me I was bordering on being obese if I didn't cut back on something. I was constantly grazing, constantly eating sugary things and fatty things, and so I wasn't even aware of it. It's just something that crept up on me.
But if you go to a garden center in Northern Ireland, as I did, by that big lake you have there, the scones and the donuts and the cream teas. There's nothing like a Northern Irish garden centre.
And you get yourself a good traditional Ulster fry. What you're going to find is not just greasy sausages and bacon and things like that. You get about three different types of fried bread on the one plate.
Have you two seen Beard Meets Food on YouTube?
No.
It's a guy, surprisingly enough, with a beard who does basically food eating. He goes to food challenges around the world and eats ridiculous amounts. He is buff, and because he just scientifically looks at how many calories he eats in a week, and if he does a food challenge, he'll have lettuce and water for 3 or 4 days afterwards. And on an average week, his calories are normal, and he works out like a bugger. And he eats inhuman amounts when he's doing a challenge. Well, isn't that pretty good evidence that it really is a mental choice not to say no?
Yeah, it is. It undoubtedly is. And so it's a matter of conscientiousness, of the personality trait conscientiousness. Do you have impulse control? Do you take that extra slice of cake, or do you not? Neuroticism is associated with it's associated with fluctuation in weight, i.e. people eat because they're sad, then they realize they're fat, and then they feel crap, and then they lose loads of weight because they're sad, and then they put it back on again. So fluctuation. And also simply with being thin, because if you feel crap, then you often don't want to eat. So you have neuroticism is an interesting one, but then the main thing, impulse control, conscientiousness, and there's social class differences in this trait, and that's why you see. I mean, I've been to poor areas like Bridgend in Wales. Went into the Tesco there in 2007, was it, or six? And everybody was fat, and I don't just mean fat; I mean fat. And it's just poor impulse control. So, don't give me that Oprah. And she's probably taken a Zempic. In fact, I'm sure she has. I think there's something kind of dishonest about it. It's like having plastic surgery. Like, lose weight by exercising and not eating as much. It's cheating.
It's one of my favourite quotes in all the literature I read. But one of my favourite quotes of all time is my 600-pound life, and they're in Alabama or somewhere. And this guy said, "I'm so fat. I wash myself with a rag on the end of a stick."
Oh, isn't that from The Simpsons?
I think they took it. Honestly, I've seen that years ago. And, people, and they act, but they have the people who, the partners are called feeders, aren't they? They want, that's a form of mental control.
The partners are called feeders. Yeah, they're feeders of chubby chasers. They're chubby chasers, and they're feeders. Yeah, it's keeping your partner disabled, essentially, for whatever perverse reason. But I do think it's cheating. Like, I remember I was talking to Curtis Yarvin about this, and this was before these jabs became popular and cheaper, and he'd worked out some way to get the relevant drugs, like illicitly. online. He was very proud of this fact. And he has lost quite a lot of weight in the last couple of years because of these drugs. But I was just like, well, look, it's cheating. It's cheating. It's cheating. It's like women having face surgery. It's cheating. It's lying. I don't like it. Just go for a jog. Or just be proud of being a bit overweight and don't care what people say. But I don't know. I'm not a fan of it. But we're going to talk about
it's just before we finish. It's not a tangential issue though, because I think it goes directly before all the woke nonsense. Things like addiction being equated with being a disease was one of the social trends, and all the way through these processes, it's this lack. Over the last few generations, this declining willingness to take responsibility for the consequences of your actions. And there are medical explanations now for everything that in the past would have been a part of your personal responsibility in life.
If someone's just said in the comments, you're in no shape to judge it. This is exactly what I mean. I don't care. Do you understand? You may fret all the time, the person that said that, about how fat you are or how thin you are or whatever. I don't care. I don't care. I really don't care. I don't think about such things as much as you obviously do, sir. So it's
And you know. We're not talking again, but we're not talking about I'm overweight. I don't think you two are particularly, but I know why I'm overweight, because I drink too much Nigerian Guinness and I eat like a pig. So it's hardly a surprise. And I'm, insofar as I'm overweight, it's 1,000% my fault. But we're talking about people who are overweight to the point of endangering their health.
Yeah.
And they're taking a drug to prevent themselves having serious medical consequences because they can't say no. But the question I'm asking is that a short-term answer in the long term? I just don't see those drugs not doing any harm.
I think it's interesting that if you look at groups like Alcoholics Anonymous, Gamblers Anonymous, all those anonymous kinds of groups, and I hope one of you guys know more about this than me. I'm just going by what people tell me. One of the things they encourage and teach is for people to take responsibility. You know, one of the things they talk about is, you know, like George Best, famous footballer from my neck of the world, who in an interview said he did not get up one morning and decide to be an alcoholic just to see what it would be like. You know, no one particularly does that. That's not what happens. But he also said that no one ever forced him to drink. So there's taking responsibility. And I think it's interesting that those 12-step kind of programs encourage things like taking responsibility and trying to rebuild connection, proper, meaningful connection with others as well.
You know, are you familiar, Darren, with Gregory Bateson's theories of addiction?
I'm not, no.
He was a bit of a polymath. He was all over the place, and he did anthropology, did some psychology, treated people for schizophrenia. He was the one who came up with the double bind theory of schizophrenia. But one of his ideas about addiction was people in the process of being addicted have they feel it gives them some type of control because, it gives them a project. For example, if it's alcohol, they're drinking all the time and it gives them a routine. And then they can periodically stop and start. And that gives them a sense of control that they wouldn't have if they didn't if they were just in the world normally drinking normal amounts. So they go to excess so that they can row back, and then it's just a never ending rowing back and going too far. Yeah, but actually gives a weird sort of structure to their lives, which implies they have control issues.
One of the things that can fuel an addiction is that need, or that feeling of lack of control. And where you feel a lack of control in one area of your life, you're going to try and control another. There can be also that sense of escapism. So you're trying to control, for instance, I don't want to feel sad, I want to feel happy. I don't want to feel bored, I want to feel excited. I don't want to feel weak and powerless, I want to feel strong and powerful. So trying to escape one feeling for another, and this is how they believe sometimes they can control this switch. And again, that's what they become hooked on. That's what the actual addiction is, the what it is that gives them that feeling, that sense of escape, or maybe that sense of numbness, or whatever it happens to be.
I think there was one of the things that this friend of mine that was obese, that had the gastric band, said was that they were very concerned about the concept of transfer addiction. So this is, there is a general addictive personality, I implies, I guess, their conscientiousness, that they will get off alcohol,
yeah,
let's say, and then become addicted to something else, like, I don't know, painkillers.
Yeah, it shifts, and that's why I say it. Sometimes it's not the thing itself that someone is addicted to, it's what it's giving them. So someone can stop drink, but yeah, it might shift to gambling or something.
Yeah, exactly. And so there's a general need for something in their lives that gives them excitement or that dulls the pain.
And I think it's interesting as well, you know, people talking about, you know, the social media thing, the constant doom scrolling and things like that, and they're not actually paying attention to what they're looking at. They're just looking for something. And coming out of something like social media, which is so easy to get hooked on, what you're sometimes looking at is almost like a dopamine detox. You're looking, trying to build longer term gratification, not the short term quick fix.
Yes.
So without that, there is the chance that it is just going to move on to something else.
What do you think? Could addiction be understood as a, and I'm not being glib, but just ultimately an existential lack of purpose? Because it strikes me that you can dress up, you can behave in a slightly addictive fashion, but if it's to a constructive purpose, it's socially acceptable and it actually does your life a bit of good. But a lot of the traits might be very similar to addiction. So workaholism, people who are workaholics, it's rare that they get excessively judged, and perhaps they've just redirected addictive tendencies.
Or even geniuses, even a genius that's obsessed with their project and can't do anything else. Even someone like that. So there's positive dimensions to those traits.
But this is, and it's what, so for example, the amount I read, you could call it an addiction, but no one's ever going to take me to hospital because I read too much.
Well, I'm just wondering, I'm not going to disagree with you. I think that's interesting, the way you phrase that, but I'm just wondering if the difference is it's longer term gratification. It's not a quick fix, which is often what addiction is. I think that might be the difference. It's delayed gratification. It's, you mentioned the workaholic. Well, the workaholic might be doing little pieces at a time in order to get to some finished project or whatever. So that's where I think it might differ, maybe.
Now, with Paul, he reads a book and just sort of goes, ah. And then it feels he never finishes books. He'll just get a book like Great Expectations or something, read a few pages, feel better now. Let's have a drink. And then it's a short term fix that is just.
How many pop up books do you get through a week?
I miss pop up books. I miss pop up. A fungus bogeyman pop up book. That was a good pop up.
Well, I'll tell you what, Ed, wait till you get to be a granddad, because then you get pop-up books yet again.
You can dust out
all these books and read them all over again.
I'll get to learn about dinosaurs the third time round, if I have a grandson. The third stage of learning about dinosaurs.
So we're running out of time, Ed, but before I forget, you know, on the issue of addiction, is there any data for historical periods? So for example, I've heard lots of anecdotal stories of, in the Second World War, people, you had a purpose, everything was driven towards a certain purpose, the whole of society was geared towards working together for a common purpose. In earlier times, in Greek times, Spartan times, fighting the Persians, there's a combination of people had a much greater social purpose, so addiction, I'm guessing, would be less common. And also people had less free time, you're knackered all the time because life was so much more physical, you died earlier. Is addiction to some extent just a modern luxury?
I that's a very good point. I haven't looked, I will look at data on that. I don't think it's not necessarily, because they talk about, like, even in the 19th century it was noticed, or the 18th century it was noticed that the Greenlandic, for example, became alcoholic very easily, to the extent that they passed laws banning the selling of alcohol to Inuits. Because they, so there was a genetic problem. Same with the Australian Aboriginals, same with the Bushmen. They couldn't cope with alcohol. So part of addiction is genetic, a big, perhaps even a large part of it. But yeah, you would expect there to be less addictive, to be you're less bored. You've less time to binge drink. You've less time to, you can't overeat in the war because there wasn't enough food. So you would perhaps expect that, yeah.
There is something. I'm not sure if this answers your question, and you'll have to forgive me. It's been about 20 years from I read this, so I can't even tell you who it was that did this work. In things like addiction disconnects us. So used to say that the opposite to an addiction was sobriety, whereas nowadays they say it's more connection. Now, this piece of work, and as I say, it was about 20 years ago I read it. It was interesting. They were looking at a lot of soldiers who had been in Vietnam, and a lot of them had been using drugs. Now, if you think of what they were going through in Vietnam, who's going to blame them? It's whatever could help them get through it. What they found interesting was those that came home to maybe protests or no job, poor education, dysfunctional families, things like that, homelessness, continued as addicts. Those who came home to families, to partners, to kids, to a job, to a place in college or whatever, to the local church group, those that came back to a community or a family, whatever is where they felt they belonged, the cases of addiction greatly reduced. So there might be something in what you're saying, Paul. It can be, if you want to call it, it's maybe having a purpose and being a part of something. If that answers your question.
No, it does. It's such a vague diagnosis. But if you ask me what the major problem today is, especially amongst young people, it's a lack of purpose. They seem to be acting out in so many ways that people just don't act like that if you have a purpose in life. And I don't care what the purpose is, but it's, and sadly, it's become going on mad marches and just identifying with any, you know, long distance global conflict that you choose for the day. That's not a real purpose. It's this amorphous suicidal empathy that's not, and all of these, you know, pathological traits are indicative of a deeper underlying cause. And I'm fascinated by the lack of purpose that seems to surround us.
Yeah, going back to what we were saying earlier about JC and in the old days, their purpose was ultimately JC. And you had a generation that are all dead now, fought in the war. They all believed in God.
More than that, Ed, even if they didn't believe in God, there was a whole social structure that allowed them to almost not even pretend, but be secular Christians. And that provides a social purpose, even if you're not religious.
Yeah.
So I think Richard Dawkins has basically become a secular Christian.
I remember that very clearly when it was the 50th anniversary of the end of World War II, so summer 95. And I was with my grandparents. My grandfather, of course, fought in the war. We went to this thing in Portsmouth, and everybody was saying the Our Father, you know, knew it off by heart, which they wouldn't do now. There was purpose to that generation. But not to these people now with the iPads and the apps and the scanning of things with their phones, the what do you call it, those black things that you scan to you take a photograph of, and
the thingy codes,
right? That's not purpose, right? That's just,
I think they're technical. I think they actually are called thingy codes.
Yeah, they're called thingy codes. Yeah, was anyone in what are they called? Anyone in the chat know what are they called? Those codes that the young people use. Yeah,
QR codes.
QR codes. Yeah, your QR codes. Right. God didn't create or want or expect you to go into a restaurant and scan a QR code to see the menu. Fuck. fuck, the actual fuck, what God expected was for you to be given a menu with things on it like lamb.
Do you know one
bread.
Of my most skip one of the top skills I have in life is, and we need to put this to the test, I can go into most restaurants and pick the one, at least one item on the menu that's just gone and no longer available.
I had a problem with that once in a restaurant. Everything I ordered, the rest gone.
Yeah, but I do that nearly. I am the Darren Brown of restaurant ordering, and it's the most useless skill.
It's not good.
Known to man.
Is anything? I've once said at this restaurant called Dees Nerf in Durham. I said, "Look, is anything on this menu available at all?" Because I've now said three.
Do you think they're just politely saying we don't want to serve you, Ed?
No, in the end, I probably...
Why am I thinking of the Monty Python spam sketch? I've got spam.
Well, I wouldn't have spam in Dees Nerf. But anyway, look, it was a pleasure. And thank you, chaps. I'm going to... Well, to be fair, we started 6 minutes late, so we could actually continue if we have anything else interesting to say. But
is still around? Can we bring Lipton back if he's about, or...?
He's not about. I think he got a little bit upset. I don't know. Yeah. Like, he was staying with some relatives in London, and they were loud, and he had to tell them to be less loud. I think that might have caused conflict, and then he just sort of, but he just kept being.
So Ed, what might happen is Lipton might have to sleep on the streets of London tonight. He's most likely to get murdered, and it was largely because you, unempathetically, told him off.
Yeah, I feel like Ralph McTell, and I'm going to make him sleep down by the Siemens Mission with his medals. I forget how it goes. When you see the old girl by the Siemens Mission, dirt in her hair and red light shoes, and you tell me lonely. Yeah, like that. I feel very bad about that because
Did you do your homework on Tracy Chapman, Ed?
No, love.
My dinner's arrived.
Oh, I thought you were going to bring Tracy Chapman on there. No.
Is dinner ready? Your wife is saying.
I have a beef satay takeaway with thin noodles. I only like the thin noodles, don't like fat noodles.
It depends on what you're having, man.
I never like udon noodles are evil. I only like thin chow mein, not medium chow mein, thin. I'm not OCD about it at all.
Okay, well, let's hope that Paul enjoys his dinner and doesn't need to have a Zempic as a consequence. We'll see you all next week, chaps, and goodbye.
Goodbye.
Bye.